Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning come from the neighbouring counties of Cavan and Monaghan. Their friendship has grown from a shared love of the theatre. Pat McCabe is one of the most brilliant and original voices in Irish fiction. His 1992 novel, The Butcher Boy, introduced the world to his wild imagination and was successfully adapted for stage as Frank Pig Says Hello and for film under the direction of Neil Jordan. This week, his latest play opened in the Rammer Theatre in County Cavan. The Bridge Below the Town is produced by Live and Dread Theatre Company and is directed by Pádraig McIntyre. Pádraig from Cavan is one of the founders of Live and Dread. He achieved great critical acclaim for an earlier production of The Dead School, a play adapted from Pat's novel of the same name. More recently, his own play, The Night Joe Dolan's Car Broke Down, has been packing theatres across the country. You're both very welcome.
Thank you, Miriam.
Thanks very much.
Now, this new play, it's not the first time you've worked together, as I said. Where did you meet Pádraig, both of you?
Well, Live and Dread were a theatre company we set up based in Cavan, and then we set up a network of theatres around the Midlands, and we were looking for a play to do for that network. And Barry McKinney, who's our lighting designer on this show, said, what about having a look at The Dead School, which Mocknes did years ago with puppets, and Mick Lally, God rest him, played the lead part in. So we got a script of that, and then Barry introduced me to Pat one day in Dundalk, and we started to talk, and that was the start of it, really. I had met Pat once or twice socially before when I was younger and that, but that was the start of when we started to work together, I think.
So was it love at first sight, Pat?
Oh, slow burn of Ross Barra.
When you're the writer, though, and you write the play, how worried do you ever become that your script will be altered so much that the play ends up differently? Or do you remain very faithful to the script, Pádraig?
Well, I would, yeah. I think, you know, if we're rehearsing for a month or 5 weeks, a writer has probably spent 6, 9, 12 months putting this together, and they've put probably more thought into it than you. So I would be. Now, things change slightly in rehearsal rooms because of the people in the room and ideas that come, and Pat's quite open to that, but it would still be, it'd have to be loyal to the play. The play's the thing. And Pat, coming from a novelist point of view, in a way doesn't know that there's rules, and he breaks them all, which is fantastic. It gives us a freedom and a challenge, which makes that work so interesting. You know, he can have no more than Shakespeare pursued by a bear, stuff like that in it, and you're going, how the hell am I going to do this? And he laugh at you and say, well, you're the director, that's your job to work that out. So it's sort of, it's really challenging, and in the rehearsal room, Pat's there quite a bit, or I bring him in and run things by him. So no, it doesn't change from the core of what Pat wants. I don't, and I wouldn't do that on any writer.
For people who haven't seen it, it only began last Friday night, Pat, what is this new play about?
I suppose, put it very, very simply, in a way, it's kind of a swan song to a kind of way of life that no longer exists. You know, if you take it over a period of 50 years, basically, I suppose, the small town world into which I was born hadn't changed in perhaps 100 years. I mean, the most exciting thing was something has gone up by a farthing. You know, there was no such thing as inflation. Things didn't really change. The world that I was born into was very much like the world my father would have been born in, a grandfather. And so before, shall we say, the acceleration of the 70s, let's not get hung up on kind of Celtic Tigers or anything, because change had happened long before that. But it's basically an examination of the interior lives of people, ordinary people, or extraordinary ordinary people, perhaps.
What I find fascinating about your work is you manage to write so well for men and women. You just get inside the heads of both of them terribly well.
Well, I accept that as a compliment, because I think I haven't particularly written well about women in the past, and criticism has been levelled at me that, in fact, that the opposite might be true. Mm. In fact, even accusations of misogyny have been levelled at some of the books and so on. But I would hate to think that was true, because, I mean, the world, again, into which I was very like the North of England kind of world, where there are an awful lot of kids in the street, a strong female presence, like in a different way than might be perceived now, you know, constant singing, a lot of whistling, a lot of pegging sheets going on. So all that's reflected in the play. I was kind of very interested when I gave the script to Pádraig, you know, and his views kind of inverted the kind of thesis that he says these words should be spoken by the women. And then when I started to kind of rewrite certain parts, it took on a whole new level, really. And I found that kind of very exciting, really.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I suppose to me it began, and I said it to Pat, you know, I think this is a woman's play. And after working so closely with Pat on The Dead School, which was about two males in a way, that interested me.
Do you think that Ireland has totally disappeared? You know, the Ireland you say you grew up and you wrote about. Yeah. Are there remnants of it there? Even
well, I think it was George Orwell said something about, you know, that photograph that your grandmother keeps on the mantelpiece that was, you know, you say, oh, that has got nothing to do, oh, for yourself in 1840 or some scene in it, that has got nothing to do to accept that you're the same person. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. That what's 100 years in the kind of expanse of life, you know, so that while things change, that nationhood might change in its definition, you know, it used to be Catholic, it used to be Republican, now it's something else. But whether it actually fundamentally changed in any way, real way or not, I don't know.
Is it an Ireland you recognise? You're obviously a bit younger than Pat. So the Ireland that he writes about, that he knew and was familiar with, do you recognise?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Like, you know, people talk about this, but look, we're only one generation away from the bike or from bare feet going to school, you know. When I was growing up, 7, 8, 9, 10, a young child, it's pretty much what Pat's talking about. And sometimes I think Pat does be amazed that, was that still going on when you were young, or that, you know? It's not that long ago, you know. And as I say, we're one generation. You know, my father went to school with turf under his arm to light the fire in the school. You know, so, and he's still hale and hearty. So it's not that.
It's only yesterday.
Yeah,
really,
it's not that. It's not that long ago.
Is it easier to write prose or write a play? Or are they different?
Well, each form has its own constraints and its own demands. You know, as Porrick said, you know, it's all very well putting down a chased by, you know, a bear or whatever the rest. But, you know, that imposes all sorts of difficulties. We can't do it for this reason or we can't do it for that reason. And the same goes for prose, except they're totally different constraints. So it would be a fool who thinks any art form is easy. You know, each one of them has its own particular demand. But I think I love the collaborative nature of theatre, because writing, I'm 58 now, and I suppose I've been professional writer for some like 20 years, and it's a pretty miserably lonely, and it's not very healthy either. So any opportunity I get now to mix with people in a collaborative venture, I grasp it. There was a time I wouldn't have, but I do now.
Why do you think you changed?
It's not that I changed as much, that I hadn't been doing it for so long, and I was kind of privileged in a way to be able to write 6 hours, 7 hours a day. You know, it's not everyone has that opportunity, but when you get to a certain age, you think, well, most of my friends are retired teachers now, and they're out there swinging golf clubs. I think it's about time I got out of this room. So this venture is another example of that.
I couldn't see you swinging a golf club.
Lots of people couldn't.
Have you ever?
No.
No, I didn't think so. How much rehearsal is going into this new play?
Roughly 5 weeks. So it's about pulling it together in them 4 weeks in Dublin rehearsal, and then the tech week is about bringing all the technical elements in. And like, Pat is so brilliant at picking music. The oral landscape of this play is absolutely amazing. I've gone to him over the rehearsal process saying, we need a piece of music to sit in to cover this. Like, it's nearly trying to put cinema on stage in a way. It's so visual. The oral landscape is so big. But within 10 minutes, Pat would be back down to the rehearsal room to say, try the typewriter song or the song with no name, and you just play it underneath the scene and you go, that's it, that's what we're after. And we have an amazing cast as well, and Pat's talking about collaboration and getting out of the room, and I'm a great believer, and I think so is Pat, that the actors bring something else. In rehearsing a Pat McCabe play, I always say there's a wall every single day that you have to get over, just even technically, how do we do this in the best way? And like Damien Devaney, Gina Moxley, Lorna Quinn, Janet Moore and Malcolm Adams and Catherine Walsh have been just brilliant in that, and it's been collaborative. And I think seven heads, 8 heads in a room are always better than one, so you can't have a complete finished vision before it starts.
Are you always satisfied that they play it the way you thought? Or did you get surprised that they play them differently?
It's a kind of a combination of, you know, anxiety and, you know, delight and childish kind of anticipation. But what can sometimes happen, and it happened in this case, is that you have an image, whether it's a mixture of your subconscious and the front part of your brain as to what the character might be. And an actress comes in and completely overturns those and makes the character, which happened in this case. And that's, to use the current phrase, the moment when you're blown away. And you think, ah, this is the real power of theatre, where someone is so committed and so intuitive and so intelligent that they can absolutely grasp the role and transform it and make it theirs. So if that can happen with one actress, it can happen, so the play can then move to a whole different level. And I suppose that's 2,000 years ago, that magic was there. It's like, you know, that's why you do it, I think, you know, because there's a lot of kind of work that goes to finding those moments. But they don't always come, but when they do, they make up for the times that when they don't.
Because that's so exciting, isn't it?
I mean, God is there, yeah. It was very exciting, I have to say.
Do you like everyone in your play? Or
well, I think it was John Gardner said, always make sure you stay well out of it. You know, there's always the danger of the intrusion of the essayist. It's not my business to like or dislike.
You can end up feeling sorry for them.
Well, I think maybe you should feel sorry for everyone in the play. Because everyone's kind of dumped out of the Garden of Eden in the same kind of way. So I think that you have to have a dispassionate kind of view of those things. Maybe you can allow emotion before you start to edit, but by the time you finish up your work and clip and chop and all the rest of it, you know, you should be well gone. As what Joyce said, you should be indifferent, paring your fingernails like God.
As the director, can you afford to get more involved?
Do you get emotionally involved? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I do anyway. When you're with an actress or an actor trying to create a scene that is heartbreaking, you can't help but you end up walking out of that room maybe shell-shocked and going, oh my God.
It's probably different when you're actually directing it. When I'm in the room, I get emotionally involved. But when you're actually writing it, you have to stay because, you know, because the thing would run away with you then.
Yeah.
You get too involved, you fall in love with one of the characters and way off you go and you realise you've left the rest of them at home.
Yeah. Like
there's a wonderful scene and there's a wonderful scene in it where Golly goes to Butlins, you know, and
with Nonny.
With Noonie, the next thing it just changes course that something happens in Butlins. And for me and Pat, I think it was an hilarious scene. And we loved it. And then when we cracked it in the rehearsal room, the two of us were just sitting looking at each other going, this has gone to a different place. And it sort of took us by surprise, frightened us, but we were elated with the result. But it wasn't what we thought it was going to be, which is interesting.
Yeah. One great thing about theatre is, you know, reversing anticipation. You know, it's like if it surprises you, it's going to surprise an audience.
Yeah, if it surprises the writer.
Yeah. Well, and that does happen sometimes, much more with theatre, I think, than novels.
But look, music is such a big influence. We're going to take a choice of yours, I think, Pap, the Bridie Gallagher.
Yes.
So, tell me about this.
Well, when I was a kid, there were two ballad singers that were constantly playing because my father had written a song called County Tyrone, which was recorded by Eileen Donoghue. He was kind of like Bridie Gallagher. I think they were both from Donegal and they had that sort of parlour, 3-4 time kind of ballad singing. And his song was County Tyrone, but a lot of they were always named after counties, like the Boys in the County Armagh sort of thing. And these were constantly on Radio Erin, and they were constantly being played in the house. And there's a kind of a, I don't mean nostalgia, but this was the kind of current music of the Ireland of the time. It's perhaps, you know, it's not Rossini and it's not the Berlin Philharmonic or anything, but it's what was going. So there's a kind of an authenticity to it that I kind of like, and it's very simple. And that music is still very popular in many ways. But this was a particular almost subgenre of the ballad country kind of thing, female singers of the late 1950s before the show band period started to kick in. So I think it's very evocative of a particular kind of 5 to 10 years at the end of the 50s.
And you use it in this play, don't you, too? I think to evoke a particular kind of maybe romantic feeling in the scene.
Potential couples at that time would have met in, well, I suppose now retrospectively would be considered kind of drab parish halls, you know. Mm. But, you know, there's nothing drab about the exoticism of the relationship within there. So that's kind of what the play is kind of divining out, you know, that while the exterior might be drab, black and white, the interior is lurid technicolor and full of excitement. And I think it's just as valid for Johnny Deere to be the orchestration of that as it would be for Mancini.
Goodbye, Johnny dear, when you're far away, don't forget your dear old mother far across the sea. Write a letter now and then and send.
Bridie Gallagher there with Goodbye, Johnny Dear. That's a really lovely song, actually. Good choice, Pat.
It's very evocative, yeah.
But listen, Pádraig, what about your play, The Night Joe Dolan's Car Broke Down? First of all, it's done great, but I love the title.
I don't know how good the play is, but it's a brilliant title, all right. And it has really caught people's imagination. I know at home in the Rammer Theatre where we're based, you know, there is an audience that come for music and then there's an audience that come for drama. And I didn't set out to join the two together, but that seems to what has happened. And it's just a good story, I think. And the music of Joe Dolan is very evocative and memories for people. And the guy that plays him is first class, John O'Grady. And, you know, we were blessed to have him. The first night I seen the dress rehearsal even, I was slightly worried that this was a disaster. And then an audience came in and it took legs. And when an audience gets hold of something, you can't stop it nearly.
Pat was encouraging, wasn't he, to you?
Well, in a way that he didn't probably know at the time. I said to him one time, talking, you know, when the Dead School was going on, I have an idea for a play, but I don't know how to finish it. And he says, but that's the exciting thing. Let it see where it brings you. He says, when I set out to write The Butcher Boy, I didn't know Francie was going to kill Mrs. Nugent. And if it sneaks up on you and scares the life out of you or frightens you or does something to you that you're not expecting, that's when it gets interesting. So I went to write a play and I come to an interval in the second half and I had no idea where I was going to go and a knock came to the door. And to my surprise, in the writing, Joe Dolan was there. And I went, oh my God, this has taken a shift. But I went with it. And then it opened up the possibility of the music in it. I think, yeah, you have to get lucky now and again. And I was lucky with this one.
Do you remember that him? You saying that to him? Because, no.
No.
But it was good. It worked for him.
I'm a big Joe Dolan fan. One of my favourite songs of all time is Tar and Cement. Do you remember that one? The town that I came from was quiet and small. We played in the meadow where the grass grew so tall that it goes into a kind of an East European little dog. I don't remember anymore. Yeah. But when I saw the play, I just thought it was fantastic. I mean, it defies theatrical convention in a way. You come away. I mean, there's even a play going on next door in the theatre with all these Joe Dolan fans. You could have another play going on out there.
Alongside
it. Yeah.
But how often would you start a work and honestly not know where it's going to go?
Always.
Really?
Always, yeah, without fail, yeah. Never
know.
That's
so interesting.
Never know.
So you don't sketch out?
Nothing, no. That's probably unwise. I mean, sometimes I teach writing and halfway through the writing course, people say, you keep telling me to not. But now he says, I'm writing all over the walls and all over the floor and I don't know what I'm doing. I'm getting upset about all this. What do I do with all this stuff? So it's not the best advice for everybody. Some people prefer to plan it out. But for me, it's a kind of a constant one novel. Just keep on writing and chop it up into wee bits then.
When did you first think you could write?
Well, my father was a fine writer, you know. He was a very literary man and he was very well read. So I suppose you kind of look up to your dad and you think, He was really big into comics. He used to arrive home with the Dandy every Monday night and I was waiting for this Dandy. I couldn't wait to read. He was particularly like the Purple Cloud. And he says, no, you're not getting it till I'm finished with it. And, I thought, this is everybody's dad did.
Like, how old would you have been roughly? Around?
Seven.
Oh, young.
Mm. Mm. 7 or 8. And he would have read a lot of you know, pulp thrillers and things, Sexton Blake mysteries and all those things. So I suppose because he wanted to be a writer himself and he was a beautiful handwriter, I kind of was aspiring to him, his station really. And so I started writing seriously, I suppose, when I was about 11 because I had a teacher who was very encouraging. But discovered the joys of penmanship. He says, locked myself away, would love the smell of ink and I used to steal stationery and things like that. So I knew I had a bit of a problem.
But to start writing for the 11 is quite young. Was it because there was that teacher? Was there someone who encouraged you to write?
Oh, yeah, there were any amount of people who encouraged me, yeah. Went to a primary school in Clonus, St. Eunuch's, which was really, looking back on it now, almost a classical education. There was a 7th class at that time. There used to be 6th class. We were doing like almost second year university mathematics, theorems and things like that, you know. I mean, this wouldn't have been for everybody because they had a scholarship class. It would be about 12 to 15 people. And so literature certainly wasn't frowned upon there either. So it was a very good grounding in almost a classical kind of way. Then when you got a bit older, you kind of went the sporty direction or you went the kind of brain box direction or whatever you might call it. You had stupid glasses on, you going round books.
And you went the brain box direction.
So you know, every time you go wind at the ball, you used to fall on the thistles. So it's a cliched upbringing, really, isn't it? I mean, that's the way it usually breaks down. But I mean, you used to get on very well with the football. It's just no good.
Was it a pity? Your dad died, I think, when you were 17.
That was quite young, yeah.
So your first published work, was that when you were about 22? He wouldn't
about
have 22. Seen that.
No, he wouldn't have seen that, no. No. But, I mean, he was published himself, you know. I mean, he used to write these songs. Actually, there's a connection with Joe Dolan and the Drifters because the trumpet player in Joe Dolan's band, the drifter, was Frankie MacDonald, who my father used to teach him the trumpet. And Frankie himself told me that he used to sit with my old man and he'd whistle a tune and my old man would just write it down in staff notation. So he was very, very gifted. He should have maybe ended up in the Brill Building or somewhere in New York, you know, honestly, as a songwriter, if things had been otherwise.
You were a lucky generation in one way, though, because you say your father had all this ability, but I suppose he was just born a bit early in Ireland when those opportunities weren't there.
I think that's very
there.
True, yeah. I think it was basically what it was, free education. Is Donald O'Malley's bill, you know, opened that all up to our generation.
When did you know you were creative and you could write and direct?
Well, it's strange in a way, you know. My father would have had a big influence on that as well, Miriam. Not in a forceful way, but my father was a guard, and if he ever had meetings in the depot in the Phoenix Park or whatever, or a day in Dublin, like Eason's was then his first race. And like, I was brought up surrounded by books, you know, McGarren, John B. Keane, all that stuff was in the house from a very early age. So when I sort of finished with the Secret Seven or the Famous Five, it was there. McGarren's The Dark, Mannix Flynn's Nothing to Say, all that stuff was there, which is an eye-opener for around 10 or 11. And then I remember particularly theatre. I was brought by my mother. We had an uncle, Daddy's brother from Mayo, was living with us, and she brought him to see the Playboy of the Western World in Shercock Hall, and I was about 10, and it was Gary Hines' production that Druid did, I think the definitive production still, but I remember being blown away. And as much them coming out of the theatre, my mother was talking to someone in the car park, and then I seen Marie Mullen and Mick Lally coming out as real people with their little bags over the shoulder, and realising or trying to work out in some way that they were only pretending to do this for us. And it was after being so real for me. And that's, I used to plague them then. I didn't know anything. I didn't know about the Abbey Theatre. I was 10. I didn't know, and I thought nearly Druid was the only one. But I remember shortly after that being brought to an amateur drama festival to see something as well. And even though I was only 10, I knew it wasn't very good, and I knew what was wrong with it. And I even thought at that stage I could fix it if they'd have let me. And I plagued them then to bring me everywhere to theatre, and became, that was sort of my thing. Quietly now, you didn't shout about it at school greatly or anything, but it was my thing. But it probably started with books in the house, and good books, you know.
Was theatre at all part of your young life, or did you like the cinema when you were growing up?
Well, in a small town in those days, there was just the local hall. But remember that we had one of Ireland's finest playwrights at the time living there, you know, which was a huge kind of privilege. We were very aware that Eugene McCabe, who had written The King of the Castle, which was sort of cause célèbre at the time, you know, still a magnificent play. So my mother would say, look, there he is, there's the scholar. And I thought, oh, it must be really good to be a scholar. I wouldn't mind. Maybe I could get a bit of that. And other people say they wouldn't say there's the Egypt that disgraced the local football team. They'd say there's the scholar. So that was kind of how it was. But ultimately, you know, the cinema being the most democratic kind of arena, it was so cheap to go to the movies. So, I mean, again, because my parents were very interested in the cinema and knew an awful lot about it. And a lot of those movies are in this play, The Spiral Staircase, Three Coins in the Fountain, all the movies. There was a kind of a lot of women's movies at that time. I mean, they talk now about, you know, strong women and brave women, but the characters in those movies were extraordinary. They were bigger than anything that you could even imagine, you know, like Joan Crawford and Betty Davis and these people. And I suppose I voraciously kind of ate up my own parents' imagination before then, getting into the whole 60s revolution. I mean, you would even be aware of the Nouvelle Vague and all. I don't know how, but somehow you'd know a bit about it, that there's weird arty films with writing on them, you know, that are pretty good too. And, but mostly it was Westerns and spy movies and all that. But anything that came, I went to it because it was cheap.
Interesting, you both ended up living in London for a while, did you? You did, yeah, anyway, Pork. Yeah, yeah. You did two paths, didn't you?
Yeah.
Well, I went back to train quite late, about 24 or 5, to be an actor, and I trained in Cardiff, and then my first job then was in Manchester, and then it was sort of the thing to do as an actor that had trained in the UK was to end up in London. Now, most of the time I was a barman, to be honest, you know, while you're waiting for the next job to come. On a practical end, what I realised in London, and I copped on, and I copped on quite quickly, if you're not creating your own work, you probably won't last in this game. You know, all the good actors in London that were working all the time, if they weren't doing a show in the West End, they were doing something to create themselves in an upstairs room in the Hen and Chickens or something. And when I look back across here, what was going on, it was the same thing, that the actors that were working were creating their own work. Right. So I began to cop on to that you can't sit in a flat in London and wait for an agent to ring you to offer you an audition every day, because it won't happen. And by working, you're seen. So then I had to come home for another reason. But then while I was at home, I decided that, yeah, it's time to make a move and create your own.
The other reason was your brother.
That's right. I was doing Howie the Rookie in Manchester, in the Library Theatre in Manchester, and we had a week's holidays before we went on tour with it, and I come home and Liam hadn't been well, very tired and all that, which isn't like him. And we brought him down to the hospital the next day, myself and my mother, and a few days later after a biopsy, he was diagnosed with leukaemia. So I went back and did the tour, and I was over and back during that time, and thankfully, I was a match for the bone marrow transplant, so I came back to do that operation. And then while I was at home, I met my now wife, Lisa. I sort of knew I was going to stay for a while, so I went back and did my master's in theatre studies at night. And myself and Aaron Monaghan and Mary Hanley set up Live and Dread. So it sort of all happened around the one time, you know. So then I ended up staying. But I suppose, you know, London might have been, it might have been done for me then anyway, and this just was the catalyst to bring me home.
It was a happy ending though, because you were a perfect match, and your brother, he just got married, didn't he? He's great.
That's right, he got married the day before St. Patrick's Day there, yeah. So yeah, no, I think the operation's about 10 or 11 years ago now, so great. Yeah, no, yeah, very happy ending, yeah.
Great. Did you like your time in London?
I loved it, absolutely. I still go there a lot. I was there overall about, I suppose, 9 or 10 years really. My kids were reared there practically. I suppose the great thing about London, it doesn't make any promises. You know, it's, you know, as Porrick says, get out and do it or don't do it. Nobody cares either way.
Mm. Could it take the next piece of music? Mick Flannery?
My choice, yeah. Ships in the Night. Me and Lisa, my wife, are big fans, and we've seen him a good few times in the Olympia, and I particularly like this song, so it's for Lisa.
Mick Flannery there, beautiful song, Ships in the Night. Listen, you both choose to live in the border counties.
Yeah, subconsciously. I think it, maybe by being away in some way, you become more attached. Like we were talking about London before, and maybe subconsciously there's something drawing you back. I don't know. I'm happy to live there now. I've a young family and they're going to school there and all that. And to be honest, it's nearly, I'm 40 this year, it's nearly as if I've done the city thing and all that, and I'm quite happy to live there. And it's near enough Dublin now, there's a new motorway, so it doesn't really affect my work in any way. Yeah. But it's a great place to live. We've a great community there, and just landscape and all that stuff sort of feeds into the work in a way, I suppose.
And you, Pat, you live in Clonus?
Yeah. It always seemed to be like the town itself, confined to a number of streets, that it didn't really extend beyond that, probably because we didn't have a car or we didn't drive or anything else. So it was a kind of weird microscopic kind of world. So we kind of looked at everything. I suppose the Butcher Boy is full of that, you know, almost attributing significance to an old paper stuck on a grating, you know, and maybe it should be taken off to some kind of institution or something. You know? But that was the kind of the way it was. So I didn't really subscribe to a lot of things like, you know, received notions of tradition, you know, and ideologies and all the rest of it. I kind of wanted to make up my own version of it. So, I mean, the great mistake often with my work is that they, you know, apprehended or analysed it in a naturalistic way, as if this is about a real place. In fact, you know, the town I grew up in was a kind of a point of departure, you know, that was the kind of template, all right. But after that, the fiction became something entirely different, almost a way to recast the world in your own kind of way or something.
Why do you choose, though, to go back to where you came from?
Well, I mean, you're never going to know a place the same way again. It's the first place that you apprehend the world. Is the, you know, the things that you remember are still in the air. You know, it's you're only on the earth a short, relatively short time anyway. I mean, you're never going to know. I mean, I've lived in other towns like Longford. I've taught in Balbriggan and various. I love them all, but they would never be the same. And I don't mean that in a sentimental, nostalgic way at all. There's still a kind of shock of recognition even yet over little parts of it, you know.
Do you think it's very different, Pádraig, when you live in places like Ballybor or Clonus instead of big cities like Dublin or Cork?
You know, we think Everton centres around Dublin and, you know, it's all cappuccinos and paninis. You know, there's a whole rural world out there where I live and that doesn't come into the radar at all. And that's great as well.
Do you think it's different living somewhere like Clonus?
I wouldn't even bring it down to the rural thing. I was listening to Kevin Bean Olin on John Bowman's programme there a couple of Sundays ago, and he was talking about when they built those new estates in Cabra and Crumlin and everywhere else, that a lot of the inner city people went out to these places, you know, from Sean McDermott Street, but they only lasted a week. They couldn't wait to get home. Dublin is only a generation away from that kind of attachment to place. You know, it seems extraordinary. You know, it's a long way from cosmopolitanism, that kind of thing. The kind of hysterical rush towards pseudo-modernism in Ireland. I mean, it was predictable in a way, but I think that's all settled now. I think people are, you know, just reflecting on that weird little bubble. But that's all it was.
Weird little bubble, yeah. Mm. But reams have been written and said about the little bubble and what happened. But what do you think of Ireland that we have now?
Oh, I don't think novelists or writers should ever open their mouths about things like that. I think that, you know, if you want the answers to those things as a writer, you go back to Sophocles and Shakespeare. You don't start, you know, quoting the latest journalist. I think it'd be spurious and a waste of time for me to have anything to say about that. And anything that I might have to say about it might be contained in a little place like this, you know, somewhere buried in there. But I certainly, as an essayist or a commentator, I think we've had suffered from an excess of punditry, really, in this country, to be honest.
You reflect on the importance of religion, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, what's more important than religion? You know, it's so allied closely to art. It has to be important, you know. The Bible, the rarest book ever written, you know. I mean, if art or narrative is about anything, it's about taming chaos, isn't it? You come into the world, what is this crazy place full of birds and dogs and trees and fields? What the hell are these things? You put names on them. You put stories on them. As soon as your child comes into the world, you're telling them, once upon a time, probably the most magical words ever written. And then it all winds up and everybody goes to sleep and you wake up and start all over again. And I think religion is the same. You know, the Christ story, you know, all these things, they are narratives. And, you know, I'd love to be religious. In fact, I think it'd be great. I think it'd be great going looking for miracles and everything.
When you grew up, I assume you grew up in a Catholic family. Did you part from it? Did you go back to it at all?
Oh, I think there's that tedious period in your adolescence, you know, where you're going, hey, Mr. Preacher Man, you know, and all that stuff. But equally, there's the kind of the Don Bosco phase when you're going around with your hands joined, looking up, see.
Didn't you want to be a Christian brother?
Well, everybody did, as far as I could see. You know, there was a recruiting officer who used to come, you know, and, you know, show you these glossy brochures of, you know, juniorates and retreat colleges down in Leash and Offaly, places that you've never been to, like where they talked funny. And,
exciting places.
You sort of pretend then you were like Brother Sean from one of those places. You go around like this. You're kind of, shut up talking like that. Will you talk right? And give bless
them.
There
were always sunny places out in Africa that
that's
they were, and everyone
right.
was happy.
That's
and you
right.
went, oh.
It's great building hospitals, the whole bit. And you come back, and your aunt would be all over you, saying you're the nicest boy in the town, and you get heaps of sweets, and you get money. What's not to love?
But you resisted the temptation, Pat.
Well, for a couple of years, and then I discovered King Crimson and, you know, Jethro Tull and all that stuff. But, you know, I mean, I'm over all that now, so I might even now go home to my wife and say, I just have the stirrings of a late vocation.
Tell Margot.
Yeah, I have to say, well, it's just the way it is. And she'd say, well, is it someone else? Is it serious? I says, yes, it's God. I'm just kind of covering all bases in case, like, I'm 58 now, you know, so I'm going to get a whole heap of sort of, what's the word,
insurance?
You begin with insurance, you know, but restitution and stuff like that, isn't it? You get in a few of those later on, you'd be all right. You know, I think that a world without religion is a pretty uninspiring place, really.
But do you believe in any of it?
I believe in all of it.
Do you?
Yeah. I think God is a wonderful invention. I think that if you don't have God, it's a pretty dull place, really. I think that's what art is, kind of aspiring towards that perfect condition. Now, there's an argument that human life isn't perfectible. But there is something about supplication, I think, falling on your knees and acknowledging, because you're not able for any of these fights, so you're better off. All the religions have it, you know, surrender.
Would you believe in prayer? Do you pray?
Yeah, I would, yeah. Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Afterlife?
Well, this play is full of afterlife imagery. Mm. It's full of silver apples, golden moons. It's full of sparkling rivers. It's, you know, what are you going to say to your kids?
You, Pádraig?
Yeah, very religious household. My mother in particular would have...
Great boys of altar boys here today.
Would have been brought to Knock every year. You know, first theatre I seen was probably religion, benediction, all that stuff. Like, and, you know, the wedding ceremony, especially funerals. We do good funerals.
Brilliantly.
Yeah, mm. And I think that's closure for people. I'm a Catholic. I have doubts. I think it was John McGahern one time was asked by a neighbour... you don't go to Mass, and John said no, and the neighbour asked him why not, and he says, because I don't believe, and the neighbour says, but you're none of us believe.
Do you find it's a privilege to be directing his work?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. This relationship, I think this is our third project together, and, you know, there's a shorthand now, I think, that we've developed, and, you know, I could jump up off the seat excited about something, and Pat sort of knows where I'm going, and the same with him.
I think it's really courageous. You also run your own production company. I mean, people talk about the rich, you know, culture of Ireland, but it's still very hard to set up your own production company.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, people say, oh, why is this play not coming into Dublin? But I've been shouting from the rooftops that, you know, theatre, art, the people of Cavan, Monaghan, Meath, Westmeath, our surrounding area, no professional company. And I think the taxpayers in that part of the country is entitled to have quality theatre. And I suppose that's why, you know, there's amazing buildings all over the country now that are a legacy of maybe better times. But some of them, there's not the good work and product, professional work going into it. So, I'm a believer in bringing theatre to where we're from and about where we're from, which I think this play is. It's bigger than that, but to have a writer from the region working with a company from the region.
And are there always still nerves on an opening night? No matter how brilliant Pat McCabe is in the script, would you still pork always?
Oh, yeah. I remember we did a preview of The Dead School in Longford, and there wasn't that many at it because the opening night was the next night, and maybe 40 or 50 people just for the preview and backstage in Longford. And we got to the interval and there was deadly silence, and I looked at him and we're after working for 5 weeks as hard as I've ever worked creatively to pull this thing together, and there was nothing coming from them, and we just says, oh my God, this could go down the tubes. You don't know.
No.
And then by the end, when we brought the play full circle, they were standing, the 40 people were standing, give us the standing ovation. And I think every performance of that, we got the same reaction at the end. But that was a scary night, wasn't it?
I think I'm always incredibly nervous, far more than Pádraig would be, I think, because I just never believe it. It's kind of in a way from being a novelist or something, you're so used to... working on your own. And I haven't quite learned the kind of social skills, as you know, and... you feel actually very responsible for dropping people in the misery that you have been used to on your own. But you feel solely responsible because, you know, you started this thing off, even though you're not solely responsible.
But it's still extraordinary that you would still worry.
Any musician that you speak to or any artist, they are always nervous because it's a disrespect to the kind of form and to the people who've bothered to come if you're not.
But if you went to that beautiful place in the sky tomorrow, would you feel you have left a brilliant legacy of work? Are you happy and satisfied with what you have already achieved?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't think about my work. I'd think about my children. The work would come after them. So that's the first thing I would think of. Then the work, I'd have a look at that maybe.
Obviously, you adore your daughters and Margot most of all. But are you satisfied with what you've achieved in terms of your work?
No, not at all. Nowhere near satisfied, no.
I think if you are, you end up in a complacent place, and then you don't lie awake tonight worrying about that scene that doesn't work.
Bob Dylan said, there is no plateau. You never reach any plateau. Mind you, that doesn't mean we're going to charge around in every bus from here to, you know, like Bob Dylan does, yeah, by getting planes here, there and everywhere. But he's very vindictive, that a restless imagination that he... What's the Irish word for a corahonach, is it?
I think it
kind
is.
Kind of restless, kind of seeking, questing. But I think that's probably, like, you know... Joyce or any of these people just cannot rest until they're constantly kind of trying to read. Now, maybe that's some kind of condition as well. For God's sake, if you get a hold of yourself and sit down. You know, like a bit of that, isn't it? But, I don't know.
Do you still write every day?
Yeah, every day, yeah.
Every day?
Yeah, yeah. Not an awful lot every day, but every day, yeah. Yeah, longhand.
And what are you writing at the moment?
I'm writing a couple of things. I've gone back to the short story now, and I like that form. And I don't know if you ever heard of Kitty the Hare, did you? Kitty the Hare used to be the travelling woman of Munster. It used to be in a Christian Brothers book called Our Boys. And you talk about Cavan and Monaghan growing up, but it was a fellow who came from Kerry or somewhere down, and he spoke like this, Kitty the Hare, there's a strange and a terrible story that I'm going to tell you now. And he kind of spoke like that. And I used to think, oh, it'd be great to write a novel when you're big that had that kind of thing. So I'm going to write one of them now. Because Kitty the Hare used to just ramble these kind of strange valleys, and peddlers would feature largely, leather slouch hats and things like that, and maybe set it in contemporary times. So I'm going to try writing one of those.
That sounds very exciting, and you sound excited about it.
Well, I am, yeah, because it's kind of nice sometimes taking an old form and situating it in a place where people mightn't expect it. So maybe what we have been calling Celtic Tiger Ireland, it might be interesting to introduce the hooded, cloaked woman from Old Munster. I see what she makes of it all.
And Newport, obviously, this play is your big
this
thing.
This is the big focus at the minute, yeah. And strange enough, I started, I was always afraid of it, but I started doing some short stories as well. I have a play sitting there. I just need to get time, I think, that I want to write later in the year. But yeah, this is the focus at the minute. And I was lucky enough to be asked to adjudicate the All-Ireland Drama Finals in the Confined Finals in West Cork in April. So that's going to take up 10 or 12 days. No, I'm busy for the rest of the year.
But look, we're coming to the end now. And we're going to take a piece of music, Pat, you love, a Peggy Lee.
In Porrick McIntyre's magnificent Bridge Below the Town, there is an abundance of circus kind of style, imagery, technicolour and constant shifts of gear where you think you're going one way and then you shift. And that's exactly the kind of mood that you have in Peggy Lee's song, Is That All There Is, you know, and someone will say, well, what's the play about? And I think the actress asked me, and I found myself saying, well, I suppose it's about something as ordinary as the fall of man. And they looked at me with, well, I suppose you can only call an odd expression of, oh, sweet mother of Jesus, what is he talking about? But in a way, I always think of this Peggy Lee song as Samuel Beckett at the Supper Club, because it's about, like, no matter what you kind of attain, no matter what riches come your way, there is always that kind of nagging longing that Tom Murphy speaks about in his play. What is this God-shaped hole, this ache? So just when you think you're the plinkety-plonkety-diggledy-die, that's what's really going on in Peggy Lee's Is That All There Is.
God, I'll never listen to that song again without thinking about all of that. But look, it's been my real pleasure to have you both today, Porrick McIntyre and Pat McCabe.
Thanks very much, Miriam.
And obviously your play, The Bridge Below the Town, it starts on Friday in the Rammer. Take me through Porrick. It's on there for a while, and where it's going to then.
Yeah, it continues in the Rammer from tomorrow night, Monday, until Thursday night, and then Friday and Saturday night in Backstage in Longford, and then the following week a whistle stop tour of Monaghan, Drogheda and Roscommon.
My thanks and sound today to Sheila Neve Wheel, to my producer Eileen Heron. I'll be here at the same time next week. Until then, thank you very much for listening. We're going out listening to Peggy Lee with Is That All There Is.
I remember when I was a little girl, our house caught on fire. I'll never forget the look on my father's face as he gathered me up in his arms and raced to the burning building out on the pavement. And I stood there, shivering in my pajamas, and watched the whole world go up in flames. And when it was all over, I said to myself, is that all there is to a fire?
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.